Well, thank you all for being here. So, hello. Good evening. Is that good? Okay. I don't want to have to think about it, so. So, I'm Dora Lee, Grindler Katona, and many of us, we know each other, and there's some new people here, too, and so I thought I would just start with my life in this moment, actually. As Linda said, we moved here 12 years ago almost in July. Mm-hmm. And I'm very grateful for my husband who's here to support me. And we've been married just recently for 37 years. And if I can say anything, we've probably been through almost everything together that you could imagine. So, and I'm grateful to Jim for all of his support and encouragement over all these years. And I don't remember exactly when I found Valley Streams, but I think it was 10 or 11 years ago. So this has been part of my California life for sure. We have three adult daughters, two son-in-laws, a daughter-in-law, five grandchildren, and two of our daughters live in the area, so we're very connected to our family. But we also have a very complicated family. Our first two daughters are from my husband's first marriage, and so we have a blended family for ever since our second daughter was 3 years old. So we've had a very challenging and also wonderful family life, and we're all very connected and close. So I'm also a psychologist, and I have a private practice both in Sacramento and in Woodland, and I've been practicing for 45 years. And I have to say that you know, and I'll tell you much more, but over time, my therapy practice has really become a very particular kind of meditation practice. And so it all sort of flows together for me now, and I deeply value that work, that healing work. And I found my teacher over 18 years ago when we lived in Evanston, Illinois, which is near Northwestern. And again, I'm going to go back to the beginning in a minute, but I had been studying with Jon Kabat-Zinn. And in that process of learning mindfulness-based stress reduction, it suddenly became clear that, Buddhism understands something about the mind that I've always wanted to understand, but I just didn't have the context to know. And so I came back and discovered that eight blocks from my house all this time was Udomba Zen Center. So I finally went, and I had been practicing in the more Christian contemplative tradition, and I went in, and I'd never sat on a zafu and faced the wall before. All the prayer groups I'd been in, we sat in a circle facing each other, and it was very strange, and I sat there, and the first thought that came to me was, what am I doing here? I'm Christian. And then all of a sudden, I had this vision that Jesus had been by my side ever since I was born. And I thought, if I can have this vision here in the Buddhist Zen Center, there's something happening. So the first time I met with Diane, she gave me a practice. She said, go home and concentrate on the out-breath. And, you know, later, of course, we know that Suzuki says that die into the out-breath rather than trying to hold on to life. Of course, I didn't know any of this then, So, you know, and actually for me, a lot of Buddha activity occurs when I'm driving. So I was driving along, and all of a sudden, I was practicing the out-breath. And then I had this sort of instant, like, vision clarity of my brother and I being angry at each other. And that we had been in this sort of angry dynamic for years. And in that moment, it all went away. And I thought, look, this is a waste of your life to be caught in this anger. So that was sort of the beginning of beginning to understand what it means to be free of, you know, sort of your karmic patterns or your family dynamics or whatever. But then for some reason, I didn't go back for a while. And maybe about 4 months later, and let me describe, this Zendo was actually a duplex house on a residential street. And it was just a two-story house, and there was this tall fence. And inside the fence was a Japanese garden and a guest house, and there was a Zendo inside and a kitchen, and, you know, everything was there. But from the outside, it was just a little house with a fence. And there was a tiny little sign that said Udomba Zen Center. So, you know, most everybody would miss it. So anyway, I said, okay, I'm going back. And you couldn't just go in. You had to ring the bell. So I rang the bell. And Roshi Diane Martin, she opened the door and she said, ah, I've been waiting for you. And that was like incredible. And really at that point, she became my teacher. So I was born in Brentwood, Missouri, which is a little suburb of St. Louis. I'm definitely a Midwestern girl. And my name, Dora Lee, is the combination of my father's mother's name, which is Norma Lee, and my mother's mother's name, which is Dorothy. And they put them together and came up with Dora Lee. But my father's mother died when I was 9 months old, so I never really knew her. And so I heard the story that she and my other grandmother never really got along. So I sort of created the story that I was sort of here to, like, bring peace or bring some gap, be a bridge between the families. And it wasn't until maybe 2 months ago I went to this workshop and I was telling people about my name, and somebody said, well, don't you think your paternal grandmother held you when you were born? And I'd never had that thought before. And just to sense that possibility, well, of course she must have held me when I was born. So even though I never knew her, she's in me in some way. And that changed everything. And, you know, it's what our practice teaches us, to be aware of the stories we create and to not hold on to them or buy into them really, but sort of notice and step back. Because our stories are usually constricted, and usually we hold fast to them. So, but I was very close to my maternal grandmother. She taught me how to sew. At six years old, I was sewing my own clothes. I loved to sew. But she was kind of a tragic figure. Like, by the time I knew her, she seemed kind of, like, isolated. She didn't have very many friends. She, you know, didn't have a lot to do with her life. And she had moved to St. Louis, my mom and my grandparents moved to St. Louis when my mom was in college. So, but she had been, she got her master's degree in theater from Northwestern. This is my grandmother. So she, back then, she was like somebody who had a lot of talent. But she ended up having something wrong with her brain that she would confabulate. She would make up stories, and they were like amazing stories. Like she went to meet with the Queen Elizabeth in England, but she was such a, you know, good actress that everybody believed her. You know? But anyway, I was in training to lead the GISO ceremonies, and the training is to participate. And I was thinking of my grandmother and, you know, how much she must have felt misunderstood. And I realized that I had never told her that I loved her. And so I made her an offering, which is this quilt. She made quilts. And I put it on the altar for GISO and just could tell her that I love you. And I brought the quilt home and I put it on my altar. And I don't know, many months later, sitting on my cushion, suddenly I realized, oh, this is my quilt. This is the quilt of my life. And it's not finished. Look at all the edges. But I still have more life. And again, this is something that is what the Dharma says. You know, the Dharma turns, that me and you aren't separate. Me and my grandmother are somehow intertwined, and so something of hers is now mine. So my father was a businessman. He was vice president of a barge line company, but he always seemed unhappy. And he had an incredible tenor voice. He was trained to be a professional tenor. In fact, he was. In the evenings, he would be hired out to sing solo, like in synagogues and churches. And he sang to me when I was little. And I really feel that that was sort of the seed, because to hear such beauty and such purity in music, which other people have mentioned, just awaken something in you that's beyond you. So I'm grateful to him for that. And I also felt like he never lived his passion. I used to beg him, I don't care if we're poor, just sing. And he would just laugh at me. So something about being true to yourself, I guess, was there for a long time. But my mother was a very sort of needy, self-focused mother, and a lot of times I wasn't sure who's the mother and who's the daughter. Is it, am I the daughter, am I the mother? It was very confusing. But she also was often preoccupied, and so, you know, in my home life I felt lonely a lot. And I would go into my room, and I got this journal, and I would, like, write a big question, like, does God exist? Is Mary a virgin? What's the purpose of life? And then I would just write my answers as they would come, like, every week or so. And I never showed anybody this journal. I kind of wish I had it now. I don't. But I guess this sense of, you know, searching or wanting to know. And I was raised in the United Church of Christ, but at age 13, I know some of you know this story, my best friend suddenly announced she had converted to Catholicism. And this was, like, horrifying to me, because I had been raised to be prejudiced against Catholics. And so, but, you know, she's my best friend, so there has to be something here. And so I started going to the Catholic Church so I could learn about Catholicism. And then I would come back to my church. And, you know, I guess I was sort of impudent or whatever you would say. But I would go to the minister and I'd say, well, what do we believe? And somehow, whatever his answers were, I decided he didn't know. So. But, you know, then I began to realize, oh, well, a spiritual journey is one where you have to ask the questions. it's a journey. It's not a belief system. So I started a little ecumenical movement, and I gave some sermons in my church, and then you also know, I've told you before, I got very involved in the civil rights movement. I tried to integrate my church, all these like kind of naive things. And then I went to college in Indiana, DePauw University, which is in Greencastle, Indiana, which is this very small liberal arts college, and it really wasn't a good fit for me. You know, in the freshman quadrangle, I looked out my window, and the Ku Klux Klan had brought like a 20-foot cross and set it on fire in the middle of our college campus. I was the first of two girls to ever leave a sorority at the school. It was a very fraternity sorority based. So, you know, by the end of my freshman year, I was completely radicalized and, you know, but not really fitting in exactly. So I got very politically active in a lot of different ways, against the war in Vietnam, against racism. But then when I was a junior, I went to Kenya. I lived in Kenya for 3 months as part of a youth program. We lived with the Kuria people in the bush and built a science laboratory for the school. We worked with African carpenters, and I totally loved being there. It was an incredible experience. And like, I arrived in Nairobi, and you know, here were all these African people who had been educated. They'd gone to Russia or England and had, you know, knew English, but I couldn't understand a word they said. Their accent was so different from mine that and then here were people speaking Swahili and different African languages, and I couldn't communicate with anybody. Plus, of course, it's a tribal culture, and just to learn, you know, how to navigate was so. But basically, everything that I knew about what I thought was reality was burst open. I couldn't talk to people. It wasn't the same culture. You know, someone who ended up being my friend, his mother had just died, and she was buried right behind his hut. So he was sleeping right next to his mother who had just been buried. I mean, things that I had never heard of before. So for me, this was a spiritual awakening, because, you know, that's what this is about. We think we know. We have fixed ways of seeing things, and those assumptions that we make are usually not it. So, so anyway, that was an important experience for me. So then I graduated from college, and by this time I was a feminist. I was a, you know, radical. I was, you know, protesting the war and civil rights, and I moved to Chicago. I lived in the commune on 18th and Halsted, which is in the middle of the urban slum. And really, my 20s, and other people have talked about this, it felt like it was like the cauldron that lit the flame of my destiny, because so much happened, and yet it was so chaotic. I was on the defense committee for the Chicago 13, who burned draft files. I worked for the American Friends Service Committee and helped people stay out of the draft. I lived in probably 7 different apartments. I was in a commune. But underneath all of this, I was completely lost and depressed. And somewhere during this time, I had this, it was sort of like, I don't know, like a flashback or something, where I realized that when I was really little, something must have happened to me, and I created a room inside my psyche that had no doors and no windows, and that some part of me was still in that room, and that I don't know how it could be, but I understood that I did this because that's the best way to make sure I keep a secret. I can't get out. But I also created this in such a way that it kept the secret from me, too. There's many layers to all of that, but I guess what I want to say is that I feel like Buddhism helped me understand that we have to liberate all parts of ourselves. And that because Buddhism wants to be open to everything, and that our conditioned life, our karma is entwined with enlightenment and liberation. And it took me a long time, but I began to understand that this is the access to my own realization of my Buddha nature, is to liberate this part of myself that had been left in that room. So, meanwhile, during all this lostness, I met Eugene Genlin, who was a philosopher at the University of Chicago and also a psychologist who worked with Carl Rogers. And he had developed and discovered that there's a level of human capacity where we get underneath what we know and what we think, and we can access a kind of wisdom in our body. And somehow meeting him and learning this process and meeting other people who were practicing was a beginning of something for me. And then I lived in another commune. And we had a food co-op, we had a dream group, we had a women's group, we practiced meditation together. So at this point, I decided I wanted to go to the divinity school, so I applied to the divinity school at the University of Chicago. And that was an incredible experience because I got exposed to all the Eastern religions, to the religious imagination, and the Christian mystics. And here I am studying Sanskrit and reading the Rig Veda, and there was one him in the Rig Veda, I'm not going to read it all, but it says, "Neither was there death nor immortality, nor was there any sign then of night or day. Totally windless by itself, the One breathed. Beyond that, indeed, nothing whatever was." And there was something about the One breathed that suddenly I said, oh, we're all of the breath. You know, so that first thought that, again, not till I learned about Buddhism that I understood that there is no self, that we're all interconnected. This planted that seed, the One breathed. And it's kind of like in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, you are not it. In truth, it is you. That is sort of what the Dharma is. I also read Kierkegaard, and again, like when I go back, the way I remember the phrase isn't exactly the way it is in the book, but what I remember is Kierkegaard said, "I swoon in the face of my own freedom." I swoon in the face of my own freedom. And you know, I read that and I thought, oh my God, as children, we know of our own freedom and we just get too scared. It made sense in a way. But then I began to wonder, well, what is freedom then? And that's really what, again, this way-seeking mind, you know, was somehow working on. So anyway, so then Jenlin hired me to help start this Focusing Institute, and he hadn't developed all his ideas yet. And so he said, now, I want you to go inside and find a place where you're all okay. So I would leave the office. I was now working in his office. I would walk home. Where's the place inside where I'm all okay, you know? For a long time, you know, nothing. And then one day, and this is funny, right, because of the story of Buddha, I looked up at the star, the evening star, and suddenly the thought came, you're not your problems. And it's like, oh, I have problems, but I'm not my problems. And this whole space opened up. And then all the Christian mystics I've been reading all made sense to me. And then, you know, all this time, you know, you're supposed to find your identity when you're in your 20s. You know, that's what all the books say. And I was lost and I couldn't find my identity. And then, oh, I'm a mystic. That's who I am. It was like so freeing and liberating. And so then, I mean, everything kind of opened up. I decided to get my doctorate in psychology, and I took this sort of discovery of this cleared space that I had discovered in this practice and based my dissertation on that, and you know, sort of have been a pioneer in developing this particular approach to psychology. I mean, everything was like opening up. I taught in graduate school for 16 years. I wrote chapters and articles that have been published. I taught all over the world. I mean, everything opened up. Yet, at the same time, I met my husband and we fell in love and we got married and I was so happy. And then within 2 years, 4 people in my family died. My mother was diagnosed with cancer. 2 years later, my 14-year-old nephew died of an asthma attack. And I had a baby. And it took me a long time to even recognize that I couldn't deal with any of that. So there's so many intertwining things. Meanwhile, before I met Diane, we were in a Christian prayer group, and we would go on retreats together. And so we went on this retreat, and we were in a meditation. And in my meditation, all of a sudden, this voice beamed up, "You think you're better than other people." And it was like, what? And it's like I didn't want to think that that could be true, but then something in me recognized this is some kind of truth. And it was like a light was shining inside towards me to show me this about myself. And again, I didn't know all of this then, but I've come to learn that this is the Dharma wheel turning, that when we turn the light around, that the light actually does shine and show us things about ourselves that are in the way of our full development. So, you know, the hymn to the perfection of wisdom, you know, says, since I'm nervous, unstained, the entire world cannot stain her. She is a source of light, and from everyone in the triple world, she removes darkness. And I've come to trust this, you know, that when we sit zazen, when we practice, you know, the light, the jewel mirror, the mirror wisdom, it's available to us. But I didn't know that then. So anyway, this whole thing about all this death, and it wasn't really that I was grieving the people, but I also felt like something in me had died. that was the deepest despair, that I died somehow with all of this that I couldn't handle. And so when I really started sitting zazen on a regular basis, that was the only thing that helped. Just sitting on my cushion. And it was subtle, like I didn't like suddenly feel relief, but it kept drawing me back. Just sit, just sit. And there's a Rumi poem called The Chickpea. I don't know if you know this poem, but the part of it goes, a chickpea leaps almost over the rim of the pot where it's being boiled. Why are you doing this to me? The cook knocks the chickpea down with the ladle. Don't try to jump out. You think I'm torturing you. I'm giving you flavor so you can mix with spices and rice and be lovely vitality of a human being. And that sort of describes this sort of whole period of several years of just sitting. And, you know, this poem helped me realize I don't want to jump out. And in a way, we can't jump out. The other thing I've learned about Buddhism is that it's really a practice of relinquishment. You know, that the Buddha says that the cause of suffering is that we hold on to a sense of self. And so what does that mean to relinquish, to let go, to go into the out-breath? And I went to this relinquishment session over January at Chikoji. And the question was, what are you going to relinquish for this year? And I didn't know. And then one day I was driving in my car. This is like 3 weeks later. And all of a sudden what comes up is let go of focusing. That's my life's work. And it was like, what? I mean, it was that experience again, that something's coming that's a truth that I have to listen to, even though I don't understand it. So for almost a year, I kept trying to understand, well, what does that mean? And finally, what I came to is that to let go includes letting go of something that you love. That, I mean, not necessarily, but... It can be that we don't want to cling to anything, really. And so that step of letting go, and it wasn't like I let go, because I still practice in this way, but letting go of it as an identity, something I'm defining myself by. And I realized that I can't really grow if I'm not willing to let go, even of something that I love. So relatively early in my work with Diane, I worked with the koan, not knowing is most intimate. And I guess many of you know this, where Dazong asks Fei Yang, where are you going? And Fei Yang says, around on pilgrimage. Dazong says, what is the purpose of pilgrimage? Fei Yang says, I don't know. Dazong says, not knowing is most intimate. And this, I think, has been what my teacher has helped me with more than anything else, is what it really means to practice from a place of not knowing. And and especially to practice in the dark. Buddhism is not a religion of the light. It's a religion that is open to everything, that breaks through all dualisms. So good and evil, light and dark, good and bad, that's not where it's at. And so to practice in the dark has been the deepest gift. So about 6 years ago, my teacher invited me to enter priest training. And she offered an institute in Illinois. And I decided to enter. But I entered in this sort of place of not knowing, not wanting to leap ahead, not wanting to figure out. I'd been kind of an achievement-oriented person in my life, and I wanted to stay with just what's next without knowing more. So, like, one time we were in Japan right after my mother died, and we went to Mount Koya, where Jim was and Kieran were, and there's this huge temple. Oh, there's temples everywhere there. But anyway, I was in the graveyard and meditating, and this voice said, "Go to a sesshin." And it's been like this for me. It's like that I know that voice when it comes, and I listen, not all the time, but if I listen, something more opens, but I don't ever know what's coming after that. So I haven't really talked about this very much here. I guess I've partly needed to protect this sort of embryo, I guess, or something in me that is responding to this invitation, but not knowing where I'm going, and I didn't want to have to explain myself, I guess. So I've been going to Illinois about 3 times a week, a year. Oh, my God. 3 times a year for the past 6 years, and there's been about 16 of us that have been in training there together. And I guess I want to say another thing that's not chronological, but the other thing that I really wrestled with is Dogen says this is a body-mind practice, that it's not mind, it's body-mind. And, my training is an embodied kind of psychology, but I couldn't quite understand what this means. And even Reb Anderson said the first time he met Suzuki, Reb was sitting on his zazen on his cushion, and Suzuki walked by, and so all Reb saw was his feet. And Reb said, "I can learn from these feet." So I begin to appreciate that actually our bodies know before we know, and they guide you. Our bodies guide us. So about a month ago, there was a man who came here from Sac State to kind of learn about us. He had to write a report for his religion class, and he was from Africa, and we talked, and I gave him instruction, and he was all excited, and there was still some time, and I said, "Oh, would you like to meet some of the other Sangha members?" And he said, "Sure." So we walked out, and there were probably 6 or 8 of you all sitting out there, and I just walked up to John Wark. And I said, "Hey, here's blah, blah, blah." And John said, "Well, what country are you from?" And I can't remember which one it was, but he said it. And it turned out John Wark had lived there and knew the language and started to talk to him in his language. And this young man said, "Oh, my God, I really belong here." And it was just sort of, I thought, well, this is uncanny. I mean, I could have gone to other people, you know. So, and it's not like we control any of this, but I believe that the Dharma is trying to turn the wheel all the time in every moment. So anyway, about 2-3 years ago, my teacher invited me to sew my robe, my okesa. And so I've been sewing now for 2.5 years. And it's almost done. And so I'm going to be ordained on October 20th in Illinois. And so I'm sharing that with you. And someone said to me, well, you're kind of old. I mean, most priests retire by the age of 70. But our 11th ancestor, his name is Parsva. And the story goes that when he was born, he was named Durati, because he was in the womb for 60 years. And Durati means difficult birth. And I read that and I thought, yeah, that's me. It's been a difficult birth. But then, I'm almost done. About 8 years ago, I went to a Waka poem. Maybe it was 6 years ago. I went to a Waka poem workshop. And it was part of a session, and I'd never heard of Waka poems before. And I wrote this poem, and I felt so vulnerable sharing this poem. And then I got second prize, and I was so excited. I thought, oh, I can really write Waka poems. So, and I've written many poems since then, but I kept wondering now, why haven't I written another cool poem like this poem? Until I was on the 7-day session about a month ago, and suddenly it occurred to me, because in that session it all came together. This is my path now, to become a priest. And then I thought, oh, that poem isn't a Waka poem. It's my koan. And so I want to read it to you. I've shared it once at a New Year's Eve. But here's my koan. Wandering alone inside stone, light finds itself, comes home to itself. Earth beds turn and turn and turn, soil falling through fingers now. I really think I've realized my koan. I've come home to myself. So here's my twisted vine. Realization and delusion are all intertwined. And this is my unconcerned drifter. He appeared in one meditation. I don't know why he's a man, but the unconcerned drifter is like a quality of the Buddha, you know. And I got this image of, you know, this like guy just sort of walking down the beach, you know, like no worries, no concerns. And I realized, oh, he's here to remind us that we can become attached to our suffering. We can hold on instead of letting go. And this unconcerned drifter is here to liberate us. And here's the little baby Buddha. So, I pray that October 20th is an auspicious day, and I'm so grateful that I've been a part of this Sangha all this time, and that you're my my sisters and brothers, and thank you.